The driver's eyes immediately went up to the mirror. Which one do you think it is?
I don't think, sport. It's the taxi 50 yards back, right side. Dirty white, without the dome light on. I don't know the make of the car. He's made 2 turns with us. You should pay better attention, Russell added, wondering if this was the trap he feared. He figured he could kill the driver easily enough. A little guy with a skinny neck that he could wring as easily as he killed a mourning dove. Yeah, it wouldn't be hard.
Thank you. Yes, I should, the driver replied after identifying the cab.
And who might you be?
We'll see.
He made another random turn. It followed.
You are correct, my friend, the driver said thoughtfully. How did you know?
I pay attention to things.
So I see. This changes our plans somewhat.
The driver's mind was racing. Unlike Russell, he knew that he hadn't been set up. Though he had been unable to establish his guest's bona fides, no intelligence or police officer would have given him that warning. Well, probably not, he corrected himself. But there was one way to check that. He was also angry at the Greeks. One of his comrades had disappeared off the streets of Piraeus in April to turn up in Britain a few days later. That friend was now in Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight. They'd once been able to operate in relative impunity in Greece, most often using the country as a safe transit point. He knew that doing actual operations here had been a mistake. Just having the country as a sally port had been quite valuable enough, an advantage not to be squandered. But that didn't mitigate his anger at the Greek police.
It may be necessary to do something about this.
Russell's eyes went back to the driver. I don't have a weapon.
I do. I would prefer not to use it. How strong are you?
By way of answering, Russell reached out his left hand and squeezed the driver's right knee.
You have made your point, the driver said with a level voice. If you cripple me, I cannot drive. Now, how do we do this? Have you killed before?
Yes, Russell lied. He hadn't ever personally killed a man, but he'd killed enough other things. I can do that. The driver nodded and increased speed on his way out of town. He had to find... Papanikolaou frowned. They were not heading to the airport. Too bad. Good thing he hadn't called it in. Well, he allowed himself to lay back, shielding himself with other vehicles. The paint job on the Fiat made it easy to spot, and as traffic thinned out, he could take it a little more casually. Maybe they were going to a safe house. If so, he'd have to be very careful. But also, if so, he'd have a valuable piece of information. Identifying a safe house was about the best thing he could accomplish. Then the muscle boys could move in, or the intelligence squad could stake it out, identifying more and more faces, then assaulting the place in such a way as to arrest 3 or even more of the bastards. There could be a decoration and promotion at the end of this surveillance. Again, he thought of making a radio call, but what did he really know? He was letting his excitement get away with him, wasn't he? He had a probable identification on a face without a name. Might his eyes have deceived him? Might the face be something other than what he thought? A common criminal, perhaps? Spiridon Papanikolaou grumbled a curse at fate and luck, his trained eyes locked on the car. They were entering an old part of Athens with narrow streets. Not a fashionable area, it was a working-class neighborhood with narrow streets, mainly empty. Those with jobs were at them. Housewives were at the local shops. Children played in parks. Quite a few people were taking their holidays on the islands, and the streets were emptier than one might have expected. The Fiat slowed suddenly and turned right into one of many anonymous side streets.
Ready?
Yes. The car stopped briefly. Russell had already removed his jacket and tie, still wondering if this could be the final act of the trap. But he didn't really care anymore. What would happen would happen. He flexed his hands as he walked back up the street. Sergeant Spiridon Papanikolaou increased speed to approach the corner. If they were heading into this rabbit warren of narrow lanes, he could not maintain visual contact without getting closer. Well, if they identified him, he'd call for help. Police work was unpredictable, after all. As he approached the corner, he saw a man standing on the side street looking at a paper. Not either of the men he was shadowing. This one wasn't wearing a jacket, though his face was turned away, and the way he was standing there was like something in a movie. The sergeant smiled wryly at that, but the smile stopped at once. As soon as Papanikolaou was fully onto the side street, he saw the Fiat, no more than 20 meters away, and backing up rapidly toward him. The police officer stood on the brakes to stop his taxi and started to think about reversing himself when an arm reached across his face. His hands came off the wheel to grab it, but the powerful hand gripped his chin and another seized the back of his neck. His instinct to turn and see what was happening was answered by the way one hand wrenched his head to the left, and he saw the face of the American. But then he felt his vertebrae strain for a brief instant and snap with an audible sound that announced his death to Papanikolaou, as surely and irrevocably as a bullet. Then he knew. The man did have odd features, like something else from a movie. Like something. Russell jumped out of the way and waved. The Fiat pulled forward again, then went into reverse and slammed hard into the taxi. The driver's head lolled forward atop its broken neck. Probably the man was dead already, Russell knew, but that wasn't a matter of concern. Yes, it was. He felt for a pulse, then made sure the neck was well and truly snapped. He worked it around to make sure the spine was severed too, before moving to the Fiat. Russell smiled to himself as he got in. Gee, that wasn't so hard. He's dead. Let's get the hell out of here.
Are you sure?
I broke his neck like a toothpick. Yeah, he's dead, man. It was easy. Little pencil neck of a guy.
Like me, you mean?
The driver turned and grinned. He'd have to dump the car, of course, but the joy of their escape and the satisfaction of the killing was sufficient to the moment. And he had found a comrade, a worthy one.
Your name is?
Marvin.
I am Ibrahim.
The president's speech was a triumph. The man did know how to deliver a good performance, Ryan told himself as the applause rippled across the General Assembly Auditorium in New York. His gracious, if rather cold, smile thanked the assembled representatives of 160 or so countries. The cameras panned the Israeli delegation, whose clapping was rather more perfunctory than that of the Arab states. There evidently hadn't been time to brief them. The Soviets outdid themselves, joining those who stood. Jack lifted the remote control and switched off the set before the ABC commentator could summarize what the president had said. Ryan had a draft of the speech on his desk and had made notes of his own. Moments earlier, the invitations had been telexed by the Vatican to all of the concerned foreign ministries. All would come to Rome in 10 days. The draft treaty was ready for them. Quiet, rapid moves by a handful of ambassadors and deputy assistant secretaries of state had informed other governments of what was in the offing, and uniform approval had come back. The Israelis knew about that. The proper back-channel leaks had been allowed to percolate in the desired direction. If they stonewalled. Well, Bunker had put a hold on that shipment of aircraft parts, and the Israelis had been too shocked to react yet. More accurately, they'd been told not to react if they ever wanted to see the new radar systems. There were already rumbles from the Israeli lobby, which had its own sources throughout the U.S. government, and was making discreet calls to key members of Congress. But Fowler had briefed the congressional leadership 2 days earlier, and the initial read on the Fowler plan was highly favorable. The chairman and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had promised passage of both draft treaties in under a week. It was going to happen, Jack thought to himself. It might really work. Certainly it wouldn't hurt anything. All the goodwill America had generated in its own adventure in the Persian Gulf was on the line. The Arabs would see this as a fundamental change in U.S. policy, which it was, America was slapping Israel down. Israel would see it the same way, but that wasn't really true. The peace would be guaranteed the only way that was possible, by American military and political power. The demise of East-West confrontation had made it possible for America, acting in accord with the other major powers, to dictate a just peace. What we think a just peace is, Ryan corrected himself. God, I hope this works out. It was too late for that, of course. It had, after all, been his idea, the Fowler plan. They had to break the cycle, to find a way out of the trap. America was the only country trusted by both sides, a fact won with American blood on the one hand and vast amounts of money on the other. America had to guarantee the peace, and the peace had to be founded on something looking recognizably like justice to all concerned. The equation was both simple and complex. The principles could be expressed in a single short paragraph. The details of execution would take a small book. The monetary cost? Well, the enabling legislation would sail through Congress despite the size of it. Saudi Arabia was actually underwriting a quarter of the cost, a concession won only 4 days earlier by Secretary Talbot. In return, the Saudis would be buying yet another installment of high-tech arms, which had been handled by Dennis Bunker. Those two had really handled their end superbly, Ryan knew. Whatever the president's faults, his two most important cabinet members, two close friends, were the best such team he'd ever seen in government service. And they'd served their president and their country well in the past week. This is going to work, Jack said quietly to himself in the privacy of his office. Maybe, maybe, maybe. He checked his watch. He'd have a read on that in about 3 hours. Kati faced his television with a frown. Was it possible? History said no, but the Saudis had broken off their supply of money, seduced by the help America had given them against Iraq. And his organization had bet on the wrong horse in that one. Already his people were feeling the financial pinch, though they'd been careful to invest what funds they had received over the previous generation. Their Swiss and other European bankers had ensured a steady flow of money, and the pinch was more psychological than real. But to the Arab mind, the psychological was real, just as it was to any politically astute mind. The key to it, Kati knew, was whether or not the Americans would put real pressure on the Zionists. They'd never done so. They'd allowed the Israelis to attack an American warship and kill American sailors, and forgiven them before the bleeding had stopped, before the last victim had died. When American military forces had to fight for every dollar of funds from their own Congress, that same spineless body of political whores fell over itself, giving arms to the Jews. America had never pressured Israel in any meaningful way. That was the key to his existence, wasn't it? So long as there was no peace in the Middle East, he had a mission. The destruction of the Jewish state. Without that... But the problems in the Middle East predated his birth. They might go away, but only when... But it was a time for truth, Kati told himself, stretching tired and sore limbs. What prospects for destroying Israel did he have? Not from without. So long as America supported the Jews, and so long as the Arab states failed to unite. And the Russians? The cursed Russians had stood like begging dogs at the end of Fowler's speech. It was possible. The thought was no less threatening to Kati than the first diagnosis of his cancer. He leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes. What if the Americans did pressure the Jews? What if the Russians did support this absurd new plan? What if the Israelis gave in to the pressure? What if the Palestinians found the concessions demanded of Israel to their taste? It could work. The Zionist state might continue to exist. The Palestinians might find contentment in their new land. A modus vivendi might evolve into being. It would mean that his life had been to no purpose. It would mean that all the things he had worked for, all the sacrifice and self-denial had gone for nothing. His freedom fighters had fought and died for a generation, for a cause that might be forever lost. Betrayed by his fellow Arabs, whose money and political support had sustained his men. Betrayed by the Russians, whose support and arms had sustained his movement from its birth. Betrayed by the Americans, the most perversely of all, for taking away their enemy. Betrayed by Israel, for making something akin to a fair peace. It wasn't fair at all, of course. So long as a single Zionist lived on Arab lands, there would be no fairness. Might he be betrayed by the Palestinians also? What if they came to accept this? Where would his dedicated fighters come from? Betrayed by everyone? No, God could not let that be. God was merciful and gave his light to the faithful. No, this could not really happen. It wasn't possible. Too many things had to fall into place for this hellish vision to become real. Had not there been so many peace plans for this region, so many visions, and where had they led? Even the Carter-Sadat-Begin talks in America, where the Americans had browbeaten their putative allies into serious concessions, had choked and died when Israel had utterly failed to consider an equitable settlement for the Palestinians. No, Kati was sure of that. Perhaps he could not depend on the Russians. Perhaps he could not depend on the Saudis. Certainly he could not depend on the Americans. But he could depend on Israel. The Jews were far too stupid, far too arrogant, far too short-sighted to see that their best hope for long-term security could only lie in an equitable peace. The irony struck him very hard, hard enough to garner a smile. It had to be God's plan, that his movement would be safeguarded by his bitterest enemies. Their obstinacy, their stiff Jewish necks would never bow to this. And if that was what was required for the war to continue, then the fact of it, and the irony of it, could only be a sign from God himself that the cause guiding Kati and his men was indeed the holy cause they believed it to be.
"Never, never will I bow to this infamy," the defense minister shouted.
It was a dramatic performance even for him. He'd pounded the table hard enough to upset his water glass, and the puddle from it threatened to seep over the edge and into his lap. He studiously ignored it as his fierce blue eyes swept around the cabinet room.
"And what if Fowler is serious with his threats?" "We'll break his career," defense said. "We can do that. We've jerked American politicians into line before."
"More than we've been able to do here,"
the foreign minister observed sotto voce to his neighbor at the table.
"What was that?" "I said it might not be possible in this case, Rafi."
David Ashkenazi took a sip from his glass before going on.
"Our ambassador in Washington tells me that his people on the Hill find real support for Fowler's plan. The Saudi ambassador threw a major party last weekend for the congressional leadership. He performed well, our sources tell us. Right, Avi?"
"Correct, Minister," General Ben Yaakov answered. His boss was out of the country at the moment, and he spoke for the Mossad.
"The Saudis and the rest of the moderate Gulf states are willing to end their declared state of war, to institute ministerial relations with us preparatory for full recognition at an unspecified later date, and to underwrite part of the American costs for stationing their troops and planes here. Plus, I might add, picking up the entire cost of the peacekeeping force and the economic rehabilitation of our Palestinian friends."
"How do we say no to that?" the foreign minister inquired dryly. "Are you surprised at the support in the American Congress?"
"It's all a trick," defense insisted.
"If so, it's a damnably clever one," Ben Yaakov said.
"You believe this twaddle, Avi? You?"
Ben Yaakov had been Rafi Mandel's best battalion commander in the Sinai so many years before. I don't know, Rafi. The deputy director of the Mossad had never been more cognizant of his position as a deputy, and speaking in the name of his boss did not come easy.
Your evaluation, the Prime Minister asked gently.
Someone at the table, he decided, had to be calm.
The Americans are entirely sincere, Avi replied. Their willingness to provide a physical guarantee, the mutual defense treaty, and the stationing of troops is genuine. From a strictly military point of
I speak for the defense of Israel,
Mandel snarled. Ben Jacob turned to stare his former commander down.
Rafi, you have always outranked me, but I've killed my share of enemies and you know it well.
Avi paused for a moment to let that rest on the table. When he went on, his voice was quiet and measured and dispassionate as he allowed his reason to overcome emotions no less strong than Mandel's.
The American military units represent a serious commitment. We're talking about a 25% increase in the striking power of our Air Force, and that tank unit is more powerful than our strongest brigade. Moreover, I do not see how that commitment can ever be withdrawn. For that to happen, our friends in America will never let it happen. We've been abandoned before, Mandel pointed out coldly. Our only defense is ourselves.
Rafi, the foreign minister said, my friend, where has that led us?
You and I have fought together too, and not merely in this room. Is there to be no end to it?
Better no treaty than a bad treaty.
I agree, the prime minister said, but how bad will this treaty be? We have all read the draft. I will propose some modest changes, but my friends, I think it is time, the foreign minister said. My advice to you is that we accept the Fowler plan with certain conditions.
The foreign minister outlined them.
Will the Americans grant those, Avi? They'll complain about the cost, but our friends in their Congress will go along, whether President Fowler approves them or not. They will recognize our historic concessions, and they will wish to make us feel secure within our borders.
Then I will resign, Rafi Mandel shouted.
No, Rafi, you will not, the Prime Minister said, growing a little tired of his histrionics. If you resign, you cast yourself out. You want this seat someday, and you will never have it if you leave the cabinet now.
Mandel flushed crimson at that rebuke. The Prime Minister looked around the room.
So what is the opinion of the government?
40 minutes later, Jack's phone rang. He lifted it, noting that it was his most secure line, the direct one that bypassed Nancy Cummings. Ryan, he listened for a minute and made some notes.
Thanks.
Next, the DDCI rose and walked into Nancy's office, then turned left through the door into Marcus Cabot's more capacious room. Cabot was lying on the couch in the far corner. Like Judge Arthur Moore, his predecessor, Cabot liked to smoke the occasional cigar. His shoes were off, and he was reading over a file with striped tape on the borders. Just one more secret file in a building full of them. The folder dropped, and Cabot, looking like a pink, chubby volcano, eyed Ryan as he approached.
What is it, Jack?
Just got a call from our friend in Israel. They're coming to Rome, and the cabinet voted to accept the treaty terms, with a few modifications.
What are they?
Ryan handed over his notes. Cabot scanned them.
You and Talbot were right.
Yep. And I should have let him play the card instead of me.
Good call. You predicted all but one.
Cabot rose and slipped into his black loafers before walking to his desk. He lifted a phone.
Tell the president I'll meet him at the White House when he gets back from New York. I want Talbot and Bunker there also. Tell him it's a go.
He set the phone back in the cradle. He grinned around the cigar in his teeth, trying to look like George Patton, who hadn't smoked to the best of Ryan's knowledge. How about that? How long you figure to finalize it? With the advance work you and Adler did, plus the finishing work from Talbot and Bunker? Give it 2 weeks. Won't go as fast as it did with Carter at Camp David, because too many professional diplomats are involved, but in 14 days the president takes his 747 to Rome to sign the documents. You want me to go down with you to the White House? No, I'll handle it. Okay. That wasn't unexpected. Ryan left the room the same way he'd come in. Chapter 7, The City of God. The cameras were in place. Air Force C-5B Galaxy transports had loaded the newest state-of-the-art ground station vans at Andrews Air Force Base and flown them to Leonardo da Vinci Airport. This was less for the signing ceremony, if they got that far, commentators worried, than what Wags called the pregame show. The fully digital, improved definition equipment just coming online, the producers felt, would better depict the art collections that litter Vatican walls as trees line national parks. Local carpenters and specialists from New York and Atlanta had worked around the clock to build the special booths from which the network anchors would broadcast. All three network morning news shows were originating from the Vatican. CNN was also there in force, as were NHK, BBC, and nearly every other television network in the world, all fighting for space in the grand piazza that sprawls before the church begun in 1503 by Bramante, carried on by Raphael, Michelangelo, and Bernini. A brief but violent windstorm had carried spray from the central fountain into the Deutsche Welle anchor booth and shorted out 100,000 marks worth of equipment. Vatican officials had finally protested that there would be no room for the people to witness the event, for which they prayed, but by then it had been far too late. Someone remembered that in Roman times this had been the site of the Circus Maximus, and it was generally agreed that this was the grandest circus of recent years, except that the Roman circus was mainly for chariot races. The TV people enjoyed their stay in Rome. The crews for Today and Good Morning America were able for once to rise indecently late instead of before the paperboy to begin their broadcasts after lunch and finish in time for afternoon shopping, followed by dinner at one of Rome's many fine restaurants. Their research people scoured reference books for historical remote locations like the Colosseum, correctly called the Flavian Amphitheater, one careful backroom type discovered, where people waxed rhapsodic on the Roman substitute for NFL football. Combat to the death, man against beast against Christian, and various other permutations thereof. But it was the Forum that was the symbolic focus for their time in Rome. Here were the ruins of Rome's civic center, where Cicero and Scipio had walked and talked and met with supporters and opponents, the place to which visitors had come for centuries. Eternal Rome, mother of a vast empire playing yet another role on the world stage. In its center was the Vatican, just a handful of acres, really, but a sovereign country nonetheless. "How many divisions has the Pope?" a TV anchorman quoted Stalin, then rambled into a discourse on how the church and its values had outlasted Marxism-Leninism to the extent that the Soviet Union had decided to open diplomatic relations with the Holy See, and had its own evening news, Vremya, originating from a booth less than 50 yards from his own. Additional attention was given to the two other religions present in the negotiations. At the arrival ceremony, the Pope had recalled an incident from the earliest days of Islam. A commission of Catholic bishops had traveled to Arabia, essentially on an intelligence-gathering mission to see what Muhammad was up to. After a cordial first meeting, the senior bishop had asked where he and his companions might celebrate Mass. Muhammad had immediately offered the use of the mosque in which they stood. "After all," the prophet had observed, "is this not a house consecrated to God?" The Holy Father extended the same courtesy to the Israelis. In both cases, there was some measure of discomfort to the more conservative churchmen present, but the Holy Father had swept that aside with a speech characteristically delivered in three languages.
In the name of the God whom we all know by different names, but who is nevertheless the same God of all men, we offer our city to the service of men of goodwill. We share so many beliefs. We believe in a God of mercy and love. We believe in the spiritual nature of man. We believe in the paramount value of faith and in the manifestation of that faith in charity and brotherhood. To our brothers from distant lands, we give you greetings and we offer our prayers that your faith will find a way to the justice and the peace of God, to which all of our faiths direct us.
Wow, a morning show anchor observed off mic. I'm beginning to think this circus is serious.
But coverage didn't stop there, of course. In the interest of fairness, balance, controversy, a proper understanding of events, and selling commercials, the TV coverage included the head of a Jewish paramilitary group who vociferously recalled Ferdinand and Isabella's expulsion of the Jews from Iberia, the Tsar's Black Hundreds, and, naturally, Hitler's Holocaust, which he emphasized further because of German reunification, and concluded that Jews were fools to trust anyone at all except the weapons in their own strong hands. From Qom, the Ayatollah Daryayi, the religious leader of Iran and long an enemy of everything Americans did, railed against all unbelievers, consigning each and every one to his personal version of hell. But translation made understanding difficult for American viewers, and his grandiloquent ranting was cut short. A self-styled charismatic Christian from the American South got the most airtime. After first denouncing Roman Catholicism as the quintessential Antichrist, he repeated his renowned claim that God didn't even hear the prayers of the Jews, much less the infidel Muslims, whom he called Mohammedans as an unnecessary further insult. But somehow those demagogues were ignored. More correctly, their views were. The TV networks received thousands of angry calls that such bigots were given airtime at all. This delighted the TV executives, of course. It meant that people would return to the same show seeking further outrage. The American bigot immediately noticed a dip in his contribution envelopes. B'nai B'rith raced to condemn the off-the-reservation rabbi. The leader of the League of Islamic Nations, himself a distinguished cleric, denounced the radical imam as a heretic against the words of the prophet, whom he quoted at length to make his point. The TV networks provided all of the countervailing commentary also, thus showing balance enough to pacify some viewers and enrage others. Within a day, one newspaper column noted that the thousands of correspondents attending the conference had taken to calling it the Peace Bowl, in recognition of the circular configuration of the Piazza San Pietro. The more observant realized that this was evidence of the strain on reporters with a story to cover but nothing to report. Security at the conference was hermetically tight. Those participants who came and went were carried about by military aircraft via military air bases. Reporters and cameramen with their long lenses were kept as far from the action as possible, and for the most part travel was accomplished in darkness. The Swiss guards of the Vatican, outfitted though they were in Renaissance jumpsuits, let not a mouse pass by their lines, and perversely, when something significant did happen, the Swiss defense minister discreetly entered a remote doorway, no one noticed. Polling information in numerous countries showed uniform hope that this would be the one. A world tired of discord and riding a euphoric wave of relief at recent changes in East-West relations somehow sensed that it was. Commentators warned that there had been no harder issue in recent history, but people the world over prayed in 100 languages and 1 million churches for an end to this last and most dangerous dispute on the planet. To their credit, the TV networks reported that, too. Professional diplomats, some of them the most certified of cynics who hadn't seen the inside of a church since childhood, felt the weight of such pressure as they had never known. Sketchy reports from Vatican custodial staffers spoke of solitary midnight walks down the nave of St. Peter's, strolls along outside balconies on clear starlit nights, long talks of some participants with the Holy Father. But nothing else.
The highly paid TV anchors stared at one another in awkward silences. Print journalists struggled and stole any good idea they could find just so that they could produce some copy. Not since Carter's marathon stint at Camp David had such weighty negotiations proceeded with so little reportage. And the world held its breath. The old man wore a red fez trimmed with white. Not many continued the characteristic manner of dress, but this one kept to the way of his ancestors. Life was hard for the Druze, and the one solace he had lay in the religion he'd observed for all of his 66 years. The Druze are members of a Middle Eastern religious sect combining aspects of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, founded by Al-Hakim Bamrillah, Caliph of Egypt in the 11th century, who had deemed himself the incarnation of God himself. Living for the most part in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, they occupy a precarious niche in the societies of all three nations. Unlike Muslim Israelis, they are allowed to serve in the armed forces of the Jewish state, a fact that does not engender trust for the Syrian Druze in the government that rules over them. While some Druze have risen to command in the Syrian army, it was well remembered that one such officer, a colonel commanding a regiment, had been executed after the 1973 war for being forced off a strategic crossroads. Though in strictly military terms he'd fought bravely and well, and had been lucky to extract what remained of his command in good order, the loss of that crossroads had cost the Syrian army a pair of tank brigades, and as a result the colonel had been summarily executed. For being unlucky, and probably for being a Druze. The old farmer didn't know all of the details behind that story, but knew enough. The Syrian Muslims had killed another Druze then, and more since. He accordingly trusted no one from the Syrian army or government. But that did not mean that he had the least affection for Israel either. In 1975, a long-barreled Israeli 175mm gun had scoured his area, searching for a Syrian ammunition depot, and the fragments from one stray round had mortally wounded his wife of 40 years, adding loneliness to his surfeit of misery. What for Israel was a historical constant was for this simple farmer an immediate and deadly fact of life. Fate had decided that he should live between two armies, both of which regarded his physical existence as an annoying inconvenience. He was not a man who had ever asked much of life. He had a small holding of land which he farmed, a few sheep and goats, a simple house built of stones he'd carried from his rocky fields. All he wanted to do was live. It was not, he'd once thought, all that much to ask, but 66 turbulent years had proven him wrong, and wrong again. He'd prayed for mercy from his God, and for justice, and for just a few comforts. He'd always known that wealth would never be his, so that his lot and that of his wife would be just a little easier. But that had never happened. Of the 5 children his wife had borne him, only one had survived into his teens, and that son had been conscripted into the Syrian army in time for the 1973 war. His son had more luck than the entire family had known. When his BTR-60 personnel carrier had taken a hit from an Israeli tank, he'd been thrown out the top, losing only an eye and a hand in the process. Alive, but half-blinded, he'd married and given his father grandchildren as he lived a modestly successful life as a merchant and moneylender. Not much of a blessing, in contrast to what else had happened in his life. It seemed to the farmer the only joy he'd known. The farmer grew his vegetables and grazed his few head of stock on his rocky patch close to the Syrian-Lebanese border. He didn't persevere, didn't really endure, and even survival was an overstatement of his existence. Life for the farmer was nothing more than a habit he could not break, an endless succession of increasingly weary days. When each spring his ewes produced new lambs, he prayed quietly that he'd not live to see them slaughtered. But he also resented the fact that these meek and foolish animals might outlast himself. Another dawn. The farmer neither had nor needed an alarm clock. When the sky brightened, the bells on his sheep and goats started to clatter. His eyes opened, and he again became conscious of the pain in his limbs. He stretched in his bed, then rose slowly. In a few minutes he'd washed and scraped the gray stubble from his face, eaten his stale bread and strong sweet coffee, and begun one more day of labor. The farmer did his gardening in the morning, before the heat of the day really took hold. He had a sizable garden, because selling off its surplus in the local market provided cash for the few things that he counted as luxuries. Even that was a struggle. The work punished his arthritic limbs, and keeping his animals away from the tender shoots was one more curse in his life. But the sheep and goats could also be sold for cash, and without that money he would long since have starved. The truth of the matter was that he ate adequately from the sweat of his wrinkled brow, and had he not been so lonely, he could have eaten more. As it was, solitude had made him parsimonious. Even his gardening tools were old. He trudged out to the field, the sun still low in the sky, to destroy the weeds that every day sprang up anew among his vegetables. If only someone could train a goat, he thought, echoing words of his father and grandfather. A goat that would eat the weeds but not the plants, that would be something. But a goat was no more intelligent than a clod of dirt, except when it came to doing mischief. The 3-hour effort of lifting the mattock and tearing up the weeds began in the same corner of the garden, and he worked his way up one row and down the next with a steady pace that belied his age and infirmity. Clunk! What was that? The farmer stood up straight and wiped some sweat away. Halfway through the morning labor, beginning to look forward to the rest that came with attending to the sheep. Not a stone. He used his tool to pull the dirt away from... Oh, that. People often wonder at the process. Farmers the world over have joked of it since farming first began, the way that farm fields produce rocks. Stone fences along New England lanes attest to the superficially mysterious process. Water did it. Water falling as rain seeps into the soil. In the winter, the water freezes into ice, which expands as it becomes a solid. As it expands, it pushes up rather than down, because pushing up is easier. That action moves rocks in the soil to the surface, and so fields grow rocks, something especially true on the Golan region of Syria, whose soil is a geologically recent construct of volcanism, and whose winters, surprisingly to many, can grow cold and frosty. But this one was not a rock. It was metallic, a sandy brown color he saw pulling the dirt away. Oh, yes, that day, the same day his son had been... What do I do about this damned thing? The farmer asked himself. It was, of course, a bomb. He wasn't so foolish that he didn't know that much. How it had gotten here was a mystery, of course. He'd never seen any aircraft, Syrian or Israeli, drop bombs anywhere close to his farm. But that didn't matter. He could scarcely deny that it was here. To the farmer, it might as well have been a rock, just a big brown rock, too big to dig out and carry off to the edge of the field, big enough to interrupt 2 rows of carrots. He didn't fear the thing. It had not gone off after all, and that meant that it was broken. Proper bombs fell off airplanes and exploded when they hit the ground. This one had just dug its small crater, which he'd filled back up the next day, unmindful at the time of the injuries to his son. Why couldn't it have just stayed 2 meters down where it belonged? He asked himself. But that had never been the pattern of his life, had it? No, anything that could do him harm had found him, hadn't it? The farmer wondered why God had been so cruel to him. Had he not said all his prayers, followed all of the strict rules of the Druze? What had he ever asked for? Whose sins was he expiating? Well, there was no sense asking such questions at this late date. For the moment, he had work to do. He continued his weeding, standing on the exposed tip of the bomb to get a few, and worked his way down the row. His son would visit in a day or two, allowing the old man to see and beam at his grandchildren, the one unqualified joy of his life. he'd ask his son's advice. His son had been a soldier and understood such things. It was the sort of week that any government employee hated. Something important was happening in a different time zone. There was a 6-hour differential, and it seemed very strange to Jack that he was being afflicted with jet lag without having traveled anywhere.
"So how's it going over there?"
Clark asked from the driver's seat. "Damned well." Jack flipped through the documents. "The Saudis and Israelis actually agreed on something yesterday. They both wanted to change something, and both actually proposed the same change." Jack chuckled at that. It had to be accidental, and if they'd known, both sides would have changed their positions.
"That must have embarrassed the hell out of somebody."
Clark laughed aloud, thinking the same as his boss. It was still dark, and the one good thing about the early days was that the roads were empty.
"You really liked the Saudis, didn't you?"
"Ever been over there?"
"Aside from the war, you mean?"
"Lots of times, Jack. I staged into Iran from there back in 79 and 80. Spent a lot of time with the Saudis. Learned the language." "What did you think of the place?" Jack asked.
"I liked it there. Got to know one guy pretty well. A major in their army. Spook, really, like me. Not much field experience, but a lot of book learning. He was smart enough to know that he had a lot to learn, and he listened when I told him stuff. Got invited to his house a couple of 3 times. He had 2 sons, nice little kids. One's flying fighters now. Funny how they treat their women, though. Sandy'd never go for it."
Clark paused as he changed lanes to pass a truck.
"Professionally speaking, they were cooperative as hell. Anyway, what I saw, I sort of liked. They're different from us, but so what? World ain't full of Americans."
"What about the Israelis?" Jack asked as he closed the document case.
"I've worked with them once or twice. Well, more than that, Doc. Mainly in Lebanon. Their intelligence guys are real pros. Cocky, arrogant bastards. But the ones I met had a lot to be cocky about. Fortress mentality, like us and them mentality, you know? Also understandable."
Clark turned.
"That's the big hang-up, isn't it?"
"What do you mean?"
"Weaning them away from that. It can't be easy."
"It isn't. I wish they'd wake up to the way the world is now," Ryan growled.
"Doc, you have to understand. They all think like frontline grunts. What do you expect? Hell, man, their whole country is like a free-fire zone for the other side. They have the same way of thinking that us lion animals had in Nam. There are 2 kinds of people. Your people and everybody else."
John Clark shook his head.
"You know how many times I've tried to explain that to kids at the farm? Basic survival mentality. The Israelis think that way because they can't think any other way. The Nazis killed millions of Jews and we didn't do dick about it.
Well, okay, maybe we couldn't have done anything because of the way things were at the time.
Then again, I wonder if Hitler was all that hard a target, if we would have ever got serious about doing his ass. Anyway, I agree with you that they have to look beyond all that, but you gotta remember that we're asking one hell of a lot."
"Maybe you should have been along when I met with Avi,"
Jack observed with a yawn.
"General Ben Jacob? Supposed to be one tough, serious son of a bitch. His troops respect the man. That says a lot. Sorry I wasn't there, boss, but that 2 weeks of fishing was just about what I needed.
Even line animals got vacations."
"I hear you, Mr. Clark. Hey, I gotta go down to Quantico this afternoon to requalify on pistol. If you don't mind me saying so, you look like you could use a little stress relief, man. Why not come on down? I'll get a nice little Beretta for you to play with."
Jack thought about that. It sounded nice. In fact, it sounded great. But
he had too much work to do.
"No time, John."
"Aye, aye, sir. You're not getting your exercise, you're drinking too goddamn much, and you look like shit, Dr. Ryan. That is my professional opinion."
"About what Kathy told me last night," But Clark doesn't know just how bad it is. Jack stared out the window at the lights of houses whose government worker occupants were just waking up. You're right. I have to do something about it. But today I just don't have the time. How about tomorrow at lunch we take a little run? Lunch with the directorate chiefs, Jack evaded. Clark shut up and concentrated on his driving. When would the poor, dumb bastard learn? Smart a guy as he was letting the job eat him up. The president awoke to find an unkempt mountain of blonde hair on his chest and a thin feminine arm flung across him. There were worse ways to awaken. He asked himself why he'd waited so long. She'd been clearly available to him for, God, for years. In her 40s, but lithe and pretty, as much as any man could want, and the president was a man with a man's needs. His wife Marion had lingered for years, bravely fighting the MS that had ultimately stolen her life, but only after crushing what had once been a lively, charming, intelligent, bubbling personality, the light of his life, Fowler remembered. What personality he'd once had had largely been her creation, and it had died its own lingering death. A defense mechanism, he knew. All those endless months. He'd had to be strong for her, to provide for her the stoic reserve of energy without which she would have died so much sooner. But doing that had made an automaton of Bob Fowler. There was only so much personality, so much strength, so much courage a man contained. And as Marion's life had drained away, so had his humanity ebbed with it. And perhaps more than that, Fowler admitted to himself. The perverse thing was that it had made him a better politician. His best years as governor and his presidential campaign had displayed the calm, dispassionate, intellectual reason that the voters had wanted, much to the surprise of pundits and mavens or whatever you called the commentators who thought they knew so much but never tried to find out themselves. It had also helped that his predecessor had run an unaccountably dumb campaign, but Fowler figured he would have won anyway. The victory, almost 2 Novembers ago, had left him the first president since Cleveland, wasn't it? Without a wife. And also without much of a personality. The technocrat president, the editorial writers called him. That he was by profession a lawyer didn't seem to matter to the news media. Once they had a simple label that all could agree on, they made it truth, whether it was accurate or not. The Iceman. If only Marion could have lived to see this. She'd known he wasn't made of ice. There were those who remembered what Bob Fowler had once been like, a passionate trial lawyer, advocate of civil rights, the scourge of organized crime. The man who cleaned up Cleveland. Not for very long, of course, for all such victories, like those in politics, were transitory. He remembered the birth of each of his children, the pride of fatherhood, the love of his wife for him and their 2 children, the quiet dinners in candlelit restaurants. He remembered meeting Marion at a high school football game, and she'd loved the spectacle as much as he ever had. 30 years of marriage which had begun while both were still in college, the last 3 of which had been an ongoing nightmare as the disease that had manifested itself in her late 30s had in her late 40s taken a dramatic and downward turn, and finally, a death too long in coming, but too soon in arriving, by which time he'd been too exhausted even to shed tears. And then, the years of aloneness. Well, perhaps that was over. Thank God for the Secret Service, Fowler thought. In the governor's mansion in Columbus, it would quickly have gotten out. But not here. Outside his door was a pair of armed agents, and down the hall that army warrant officer with the leather briefcase called the football, an appellation which did not please the president, but there were things even he could not change. His national security advisor could, in any case, share his bed, and the White House staffers kept the secret. That, he thought, was rather remarkable. Fowler looked down at his lover. Elizabeth was undeniably pretty. Her skin was pale because her work habits denied her sunlight, but but he preferred women with pale, fair skin. The covers were askew because of the previous night's gyrations, and he could examine her back. The skin was so smooth and soft. He felt her relaxed breath on his chest, and the way her left arm wrapped around him. He ran a hand down her back and was rewarded by a and a slight increase in pressure from the sleeping hug she gave him. There was a discreet knock at the door. The president pulled the covers up and coughed. After a five count, the door opened, and an agent came in with a coffee tray with some document printouts before withdrawing. Fowler knew he couldn't trust one of the ordinary staff that far, but the Secret Service really was the American version of the Praetorian Guard. The agent never betrayed his emotions, except for a good morning nod at the boss, as the agents referred to him. The devotion they gave him was almost slavish. Though well-educated men and women, they really did have a simple outlook on things, and Fowler knew that there was room in the world for such people. Someone, often someone quite skilled, had to carry out the decisions and orders of his or her superiors. The gun-toting agents were sworn to protect him, even to interpose their bodies between the president and any danger. The maneuver was called catching the bullet, and it amazed Fowler that such bright people could train themselves to do something so selflessly dumb. But it was to his benefit, as was their discretion. Well, the joke was that such good help was hard to come by. It was true. You had to be president to have that kind of servant. Fowler reached for his coffee and poured a cup one-handed. He drank it black. After his first sip, he used a remote control to switch on a TV set. It was tuned to CNN, and the lead story, it was 2 in the afternoon there, was Rome, of course. Elizabeth moved her head, and her hair swept across him. She always awoke slower than he. Fowler ran a finger down her spine, earning himself a last cuddle before her eyes opened. Her head came up with a violent start.
Bob!
Yes?
Somebody's been here.
She pointed to the tray with the cups and knew that Fowler hadn't fetched it himself. Coffee?
Bob!
Look, Elizabeth, the people outside the door know that you're here. What do you think we are hiding, and from whom are we hiding it? Hell, they probably have microphones in here. He'd never said that before. He didn't know for sure, and had studiously refrained from inquiring, but it was a logical thing to expect. The institutional paranoia of the Secret Service denied the agents the ability to trust Elizabeth or anyone else, except the president. Therefore, if she tried to kill him, they needed to know, so that the agents outside the door could burst in with their guns and save Hawk from his lover. There probably were microphones. Cameras, too? No, probably not cameras, but surely there had to be microphones. Fowler actually found that thought somewhat stimulating, a fact that editorial writers would never have believed. Not the Iceman.
My God!
Liz Elliott had never thought of that. She hoisted herself up and her breasts dangled deliciously before his eyes. But Fowler was not that sort of morning person. Mornings were for work. I am the president, Elizabeth, Fowler pointed out as she disengaged herself. The idea of cameras occurred to her, too, and she quickly rearranged the bedclothes. Fowler smiled at the foolishness of it. Coffee? He asked again. Elizabeth Elliot almost giggled. Here she was, in the president's bed, naked as a jaybird, with armed guards outside the door. But Bob had let someone in the room. The man was incredible. Had he even covered her up? She could ask, but decided not to, fearing that he might display his twisted sense of humor, which was at its best when it was slightly cruel. And yet, had she ever had so good a lover as he? The first time, it must have been years, but he was so patient, so respectful, so easy to manage. Elliot smiled her secret smile to herself. He could be directed to do exactly what she wanted, when she wanted it, and do it consummately well, for he loved to give pleasure to a woman. Why, she wondered. Perhaps he wanted to be remembered. He was a politician, after all, and what they all craved was a few lines in history